From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, House Democrats try to improve the Affordable Care Act, even as the Trump administration launches a new push to get the ACA revoked.
It's really kind of a sad day to see the President of the United States going to court to take health care away from Americans.
How our adoption system fails kids with darker skin.
I think because as a nation, we're so committed to this construct of race, we miss the discrimination that takes place on the basis of skin color entirely.
Ann Arbor writer Erin Hahn on her debut novel, inspired by country, stars Johnny and June Carter Cash.
I studied so many hours of footage of Johnny and June. I mean, I really did, just to capture that stage dynamic.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Trump administration dropped a surprise this week, making a move to invalidate Obamacare. The Justice Department says the entire Affordable Care Act should be declared unconstitutional. And this sets the stage for yet another GOP attempt to get rid of the ACA. President Trump seems ready for another health care battle.
The Republican Party will soon be known as the party of health care.
You watch.
And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is ready for the fight.
Last night, in federal court, the Justice Department of the Trump administration decided not only to try to destroy protections for pre-existing conditions, but to tear down every last benefit and protection the ACA affords.
With us now, Flint Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee, who is the chief deputy whip of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome back to Stateside, Congressman.
Thank you.
So the GOP has been trying to take down the ACA since 2009. It failed in the Supreme Court. Senator Ted Cruz shut down the government in a failed attempt to kill the ACA. They couldn't pass a replacement plan when they owned the House, the Senate, and the White House. And the GOP lost the House last fall, largely because of health care. Why do you think the president is picking this fight again, especially with 2020 looming?
It's hard to imagine, and I've really stopped trying to figure out the president's logic, because what he's saying with this position that the Justice Department is taking is that people should not be able to get health care if they have pre-existing conditions. In other words, an insurer should be able to deny health insurance to somebody with diabetes, or that has a previous cancer diagnosis, or somebody with multiple sclerosis. You know, it's just beyond comprehension. This is a big step in the wrong direction, and it's really a kind of a sad day to see the President of the United States going to court to take health care away from Americans.
There is reporting out there that says, A, this happened despite the opposition of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar and Attorney General Bill Barr, and B, a lot of Republicans in Congress were shocked. What are you hearing and seeing?
Well, the problem is, and some of them are shocked, I will admit that, because a handful have supported our efforts to improve the Affordable Care Act. But their shock does not cause them to take on this president and to push back against him and to vote to restore, you know, so many of the protections that the Affordable Care Act has provided. They continue to support the president's efforts to undermine the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, when it comes to health care for Americans, words are cheap. I've heard time and again these members of Congress and people in the administration say they absolutely want to protect people with pre-existing conditions and guarantee that they have health care. But when it comes down to action, they go to court to try to take that right away from people.
And we have never seen a plan, a replace plan.
No, they talk about how they would have this great plan to replace. In fact, I'm sure you remember when the president was running for office, he said that everyone would have health insurance and it would cost less money when he was president. And what does he actually do? He goes to court to try to make sure that fewer Americans have health care and that it will cost us all more money. It seems as though he is so focused on cutting spending to help Americans have a better life in order to pay for the big tax cuts that he already pushed through that had so much of the benefit going to the richest 1%, that he can't think about the implications of these choices other than the benefit to his big, you know, friends that are enormously wealthy.
Let's talk about this bill you and other House Democrats introduced Tuesday, Congressman Kildee. What would it do? And break down the four major components for us.
Well, so this bill would address some of the what we see as the weaknesses. One that we have to acknowledge was a weakness that was in place even before President Trump came into office, and that is that for the 6% of Americans that purchase their health care directly, in other words, they're not Medicaid, Medicare, VA, or employer-paid health care, but for people who actually go into the market and buy their health care, the premiums are too high for some people. So this would address that by expanding the tax credits that make health insurance more affordable for more middle-class families. That's number one. Second, it would strengthen the protections for people with pre-existing conditions by stopping the Trump administration's effort to give waivers to states that allow them to opt out of those protections under the Affordable Care Act. Third, it would stop insurance companies from selling junk insurance plans, plans that feel like you have insurance until you actually get sick, and then you either get canceled or what you're trying to get treated for is not covered. And then fourth, and this is really important, you know, cynically, the president dramatically reduced the amount of money that the administration provides for outreach and enrollment assistance for people who are trying to get enrolled in health care. He cut it by 90%. This would restore the money to make sure that those navigators are there and people who can, you know, access health care can get the help in understanding what it is they're actually signing up for.
So it's bolstering, and it sounds like it's designed to improve things that needed shoring up in the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And shoring up what we saw as some of the weaknesses in the Affordable Care Act, and then undoing some of the damage that President Trump has done to the Affordable Care Act.
And what do we know as far as the way that the American public feels about the Affordable Care Act?
For the most part, what I hear is they want to see us work together to make it work, to not defend it where we see weaknesses, but actually fix those problems and make sure that it's affordable and that people can have access to it. And that's what our proposal would do. I think what most people I talk to want is for us to stop using this as a political issue and actually realize that fundamentally it's about health care for Americans. And I think, unfortunately, it has become a political problem and not really seen as something as fundamental as, you know, whether or not people can get the care they need when they're sick.
We're talking with Flint Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee. We are certainly in a period where a lot of history is being made right now, particularly this period where Special Counsel Mueller has turned in his report. Attorney General Barr released his four-page take on it, saying the president and his team did not collude with Russia. How much do the people you represent care about Russia, about the Mueller report, and what is or isn't in it?
Well, I think they care about it because they want to know what their president is up to. And, you know, the report, while it did not come to any conclusion that said that there was collusion between the Trump administration and Russia, it did find that Russia interfered with our election, something the president himself does not agree with. We want to see, and I think the American public has the right to see, all that the special counsel was able to learn about that so that we can properly defend ourselves in the future. And then they left unanswered the question as to the extent to which the president tried to obstruct this investigation. The attorney general himself came to his own conclusions, but the American people have the right to those facts. Now, having said that, that's not front of mind for most people. Most of the people I talk to back home, they want us to work on the big issues that the country faces that are really economic questions. Health care, trying to make sure we have a trade situation that ensures that American manufacturers can compete and American workers have their jobs protected. Infrastructure. People want to see the roads, the bridges, the rail systems fixed. People want to have access to good schools and go on to college or post-secondary training. Basically, people think about what the families of America are concerned with first and foremost, and that really needs to be the principal agenda that we push, knowing that we also have an obligation to uphold our oath and hold the president accountable.
And people in this state want to trust what's coming out of the tap when they turn on the water tap. As we all know, Governor Whitmer said, you know what, we're not waiting anymore for the EPA and the federal government to act. What are your thoughts about her plans to set drinking water standards for PFAS chemicals?
Well, I think she's doing the right thing, because if the United States Environmental Protection Agency won't act, she has a moral obligation to protect citizens of Michigan from dangerous chemicals. So I support her effort to initiate a state-based MCL, or a maximum contaminant level, for PFAS. I do so, though, very strongly believe that we can't have a 50-state patchwork of PFAS regulations, and we need a national standard. And so I and many others here continue to push Congress to force the EPA to do what the Trump administration seems unwilling to do, and that is to establish a health standard for PFAS in surface water, in groundwater, and in drinking water. That's the responsible thing to do. Congress should do it. But in the meantime, I think the governor is exactly right to do what she has to do to protect Michigan citizens from this dangerous substance.
I'd like your thoughts on yesterday's appearance by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who appeared first time ever for her before a Democratic-controlled House to defend the Trump budget, which include deep cuts to programs that affect teachers, affect students, and, of course, that much-noted elimination of $18 million for Special Olympics. What do you want to say to people who feel that they're more interested in supporting special ed, Special Olympics, perhaps concerned with adding $60 million more to charter school funding?
Yeah, what I say is shame on them. Shame on them for prioritizing the development of new private for-profit schools over the 272,000 Special Olympians who are just simply trying to find a path forward in their already really difficult life. This is not one of those budget questions. This is a moral question. I mean, I just think there are certain times when it goes way beyond politics. I don't know anyone. I don't know a single person who thinks we ought to cut funding for Special Olympics. So I think Congress will restore this. But the idea that we actually have to push back against an administration that wants to stop helping these kids, it's a distraction that we ought not have to deal with.
Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, in the 19th century, women could not buy life insurance without a male relative signing off. Sabina Mae West changed all of that in 1892.
Women were able to purchase this on their own. They could purchase their own policies, and they didn't have to have any man involved in it.
After the break, the life of a pioneering Michigan businesswoman. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk Michigan history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
If we have to go to the White House, I'm going as myself.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
What it means is open up your goddamn market the way we opened up ours.
From a country school teacher in Michigan's thumb to the woman who made thousands of other women's lives more secure thanks to life insurance, onto a political force who advised a president. That is the remarkable life of Sabina Mae West, who went by the shortened version of the name Bina. Here with us from the Michigan History Center is Rachel Clark. So, Rachel, it's the summer of 1891. Bina West is just 24 years old, and she creates something that is a true first. Tell us about it.
So she creates a life insurance company that is created by women, solely for women. So this was very different for that time. And she saw the need for it and created it.
And what was it that she saw in her work as a school teacher that put this idea in her head?
While she was teaching, she had two students whose mother died. And this created such a financial hardship on the family that it split the family up. And the children ended up leaving school and were forced to work. And this really bothered her, the fact that there were no resources available to help the family out, especially when the mother dies. if the father had died, there would have been resources available. But with the mother dying, there just wasn't anything out there. So she decided she was going to do something about it.
And she took that idea and she formed something called the WBA, the Women's Benefit Association. She founded it in 1892 in Port Huron. So what was new and different about this?
There were a couple of things. The first thing was that this provided life insurance just for women. It sort of removed men from the equation. So women were able to purchase this on their own. They could purchase their own policies, and they didn't have to have any man involved in it. They didn't have to have their father involved, their husband. It just solely was for women.
And I know Bina did this working through a ladies' auxiliary of a men's fraternal society called the Knights of the Maccabees. So kind of walk us through this, Rachel. How do these fraternal societies work and help their members?
Fraternal societies have been around forever, and the basic principle dates back to the ancient Greeks and the idea that every man is his brother's keeper. So you have these societies where if members find themselves in dire straits or in need, other members will gather together and help them out. And this was, as I said, it was a long-standing tradition, but it was for the male members of these societies. And so ladies' auxiliaries started coming up. So these auxiliary, these women's auxiliaries or ladies' auxiliaries, were a way for Bina to kind of get out into those groups and help them out with these life insurance policies.
All right, let's talk success. How well did Bina's idea do in terms of sales and bringing in new members to the ladies of the Maccabees and money?
Amazingly well. Within a year, the number of the Michigan Ladies of the Maccabees chapters increased from 76 to 222. And in 3 years, she recruits 7,538 members. She sells $9 million in insurance policies and acquires $68,000 in assets, which is pretty good because she started with a $500 loan.
And this, we're talking like in the 1890s. So that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. And the fact that she's able to do this as a woman is even more impressive.
And a woman who was a traveling salesperson.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So she's traveling around. She's recruiting women. She's selling these policies and she's doing it alone. She's not only not married at this time. She's not accompanied by any men, which is really unusual. But because she's not going out and dealing with men, she's not selling these policies to men. She's only dealing with women. So there really wasn't any reason for her to have sort of this male escort or a male companion to go with her. She's only dealing with women.
So she is selling insurance. She's out there. She's meeting people. And then through the 1920s, Bina West gets more and more involved in politics.
She very much does. In the early 10s, she actually represents the National Council for Women in Geneva, Switzerland. In 1919, she's appointed to the Women's Executive Committee for the Republican National Committee. And that's in 1919. And then in the 20s, Herbert Hoover appoints her to his Planning Committee on Child Health and Protection. So she is a staunch Republican, and she stays active in the Republican committees, and she stays very active in political life through the 20s.
But she was actually, as you break this down for us, Bina West was actually politically active before the 19th Amendment was ratified by Congress in mm-hmm. August of 1920, and women could go vote. So
yes.
She was breaking ground all around. Well, she was doing all of this groundbreaking in business and politics. What about a personal life?
She had sort of one, but work was mostly her focus. She married a Chicago lawyer in 1929, and the 1930 census shows them living apart. She's in Port Huron living and working on her business, and he is living in Chicago doing in his legal firm. So he actually ends up dying in 1932, but her work continues, and she really focuses on that. She travels a lot. She goes to Aruba, Hawaii, Florida. She travels with her mother. Her work, though, is really her focus.
This is a woman who would fit in 2021, even mm-hmm. with the commuter marriage. When did she retire and when did she die?
After World War II, she retires. By 1948, she decides she's going to let a younger generation solve some of the newer problems. And she wants to watch. She wants to be able to give them advice if they need it. But she realizes that the troubles post-war are something that a younger generation should take care of. So she retires in 1948, and then she dies in 1954.
So bottom line, how did Sabina Mae West Miller make her mark on women's lives in 20th century America, but particularly 20th century Michigan?
Her work really gave women a sense of security and independence that hadn't been available before. She really believed in the ability of women to be a part of the public sphere, to be part of public decisions that affected their lives and the lives of their families. So she really did give this sense of possible independence and security that just had not been there.
Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, bringing us the life of Sabina Mae West. Thank you so much for being with us, as always.
Thank you very much.
A story of two country music stars figuring out how to work through old pain, finding their true selves and love while on tour, playing on stages across America. That's the story told in the debut young adult novel, You'd Be Mine, from Ann Arbor writer Erin Hahn. And she is with us now. Your debut book is a number one new release on Amazon. Are you kind of in pinch myself mode?
Yeah, absolutely I am. It's very intimidating to be your first book that is the one that is getting a lot of press around it. So
isn't that better than it dropping like a stone and nobody noticing?
That's absolutely the case. Yes, I do agree with that. But I think as writers, you're kind of introverted. And so when something big happens right away, you're just not ready for it.
And,
so.
And that it has. I really have to say, I enjoyed the author bio, and I'm going to quote it here. By day, she likes to help kindergartners make snakes out of Play-Doh. By nights, she writes swoons. She married her own YA love interest, whom she met on her first day of college, and has two kids who are much, much cooler than she ever was at her age. That's a good bio. So congrats.
Thank you.
So this is your debut novel. How long have you been writing?
Seriously writing about 5 years, but I've been writing my whole life. I mean, I've been writing poetry and essays and whatever just came to my mind. For a while, I tried blogging. Probably have like 3 or 4 different blogs that are abandoned somewhere on the internet. But seriously, writing novels, I started about 5 years ago when we moved to Ann Arbor.
And what drew you to the YA genre?
I think I'm just super immature. And so it fits. It's where my comfort zone is. I think my brain probably operates somewhere around the age of 17, 18 years old. And so it really fits me. I can't do children's. I work with children all day. And so I like to have a little bit of a distinction there. But I find adult books sometimes a little bit boring. I don't know. I guess I'm just immature.
What do you like? What do you think makes a good young adult story?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, teens kind of, you know, they go to high school. They go through a pretty typical day. And I think it just gives them something outside of their perspective. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said for books that focus on the high school experience, and I really love those. But I think there's something to be said for books that kind of take them outside of that and let them explore a little bit more, maybe see what they want to do as they get older. I think that's why I like this kind of coming-of-age genre, which is, you know, just a little bit older, and so it gives them something to look forward to after they graduate. Obviously, not everyone's going to be a country music star. I am not a country music star. But, you know, you're in high school, and everybody's kind of the same, or, you know, the idea is to try to be the same. And so it's nice to be able to see kids who are different. YA books are full of kids who make a difference, who are not the norm, who are interesting. And I think that's why kids like them so much, because they can relate to that. And they know inside they might be more interesting than they are allowing themselves to be in the hallways in school.
Now, tell us about the two young people you write about, Annie and Clay. Tell us a little about them.
Okay. Well, Clay Coolidge, they call him kind of the bad boy of country. I'd say he's more just a troubled kid. He is an orphan. He drinks a little bit too much. He kind of was raised on the road over the last year. And so he kind of hit too big too fast is how I would say. And no one was there to kind of take care of him and tell him like, whoa, boy, slow down. On the other hand, you've got Annie, who she grew up kind of in the shadow of a really huge tragedy with her parents, who were country music legends. They die when she's 13. And so she was really nurtured and cared for by her grandparents. And I think that that really gave her a different perspective. So she kind of comes onto this tour wanting to make something of herself, but also she kind of, I feel like, is the mama of the whole group of all of them. You know, she's seen it all. She's been there. She's done that. And she just wants to play music.
And they're both crazy talented, as it
And they're
comes
both
across.
Crazy talented, which is nice. I think that they both have embraced that they're just really talented. And it's okay to be really good at something.
Now, you are real comfortable writing about the world of country music and about being on the road as a working musician. So I've got to ask if you've got any background at all as a musician or as a songwriter, or you just have a good imagination?
I have a good imagination. I have never played an instrument in my life. I was never able to as a kid. We just couldn't afford it. And so I have always been obsessed with song lyrics. I have notebooks full of them. I listen to music and I would study the lyrics. I had a high school teacher my freshman year who gave us a project where she said, bring in your favorite song and we're going to read it like a poem. And that just changed my whole world because I really thought, this is all just poetry. It's all just, it's writing. And I think that that just opened my eyes. And so I've been kind of chasing that ever since. I love writing lyrics. I did not intend to put lyrics in the book.
But you do.
You've got a number of songs in this book.
Yes.
And they've made it through every pass. I kind of thought at some point along the line that somebody was going to tell me that they weren't going to work and that I'd have to take them out. And no one ever did. And so there they are. They're in the book and I love it. But I am not a musician.
What kind of research did you do to get the feeling of being on the road?
My imagination? I mean, I honestly, all the locations that Annie and Clay stop at, I've been, with the exception of one. I really tried to make sure that it was a place I was familiar with when I brought them there so that I could really speak to the location and what it felt like. I've been to a lot of summer concerts, a lot of country music concerts especially, and they're my favorite kind. There's nothing like that in the world. So
I totally could see the Faster Horses, set here. I can see these two playing at Faster Horses in Michigan.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
On a hot summer night.
Exactly.
Did you have any country stars in mind as you wrote that story of Annie and Clay?
Oh, my gosh. I studied so many hours of footage of Johnny and June. I mean, I really did, just to capture that stage dynamic. It is very, very loosely based on them. It is not a bio
or anything like that. Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, just inspired by their love story?
Yeah, inspired by their love story, inspired by their own personal lives, and also inspired by their chemistry on stage. I mean, they were pinnacle performers. I mean, just everything was really incredible about their charm and the way that they played off of each other, and I really wanted to capture that with Annie and Clay. So while they do sing some Johnny and June songs, it really was more just like the chemistry that I would see in the footage that I wanted to portray in the book.
I know you have a young family. Could tell that from your bio. You are a parapro who works into kindergarten. So how in the world do you carve out the peace and quiet you need to write? I mean, how do you balance real life demands with the demands of being a writer?
I'm not great at it, to be honest. I think really it's my family is incredible. My husband has always been very, very supportive, and he will say to my kids, you know, this is mom's second job. And so when I come home and, you know, and I've got an email with revisions or something that needs to be done right away in a deadline, and I know that I'm going to have to, you know, go hide in my room and take care of it, then he steps in and helps out with the kids. So it's been really, really great. I'm super lucky. Also, summers, breaks, any chance that I can get outside of school, you know, I try to just commit to being able to take care of deadlines. And thankfully, my team at Wednesday Books, my publisher, and then also my team at home have been super supportive.
I guess to people out there listening to us talk who are hatching an idea for a story or a book, what's your advice? How do you go from idea to this published book that's sitting here on the table with us?
Just do it. I mean, I think I've had so many people lately say, how do you do it? And, you know, oh, I've always wanted to do that. And I was one of those people who just said, I've always wanted to do that. And it's not easy. I think it took me 5 books before You'd Be Mine that were rejected. And so I think if I didn't have a team of support, you know, saying like, you just have to keep going. You really need to just keep going. And every now and again, I'd get like a little bit of something from an agent who wouldn't choose to represent me, but would say, oh, but you're pretty good at this. You know, you should keep going. And just celebrating all those little steps along the way, you know, oh, I finished a chapter. Oh, I finished half a book. I finished an entire book. It might be terrible, but I finished it. And now I can go and query it, or I can start another one, or, you know, it just every little bit, if you celebrate the little things along the way, will get you to the end of it, I think.
And don't let rejection letters get you down.
Oh, no. I mean, I have hundreds of them, and I just don't save them. Don't look at them anymore. I don't need them. It's in the past.
Now that you're out here presenting your baby to the world, it is published, you're going to be doing readings, you're talking to me. What about this experience did you not expect?
I think all of that. I mean, you know, you sit there and you think, I'm going to write this book, and it's really very personal, and it's just between you and the characters and maybe a couple of, you know, friends who you have reading it, and you get really excited about it. But every step has been more and more people, and I guess I never anticipated that. I never in a million years imagined I would be doing this. I never thought that I would be sitting across from you and talking about it. I never thought that I would be launching a book in a bookstore. I never thought that people would be that interested in my characters, you know, and it's flattering and so exciting, but also intimidating and not something that I think most writers anticipate. You know, you kind of just think like, that would be amazing one day. But when you get to the reality of it, you're like, wow, that's a little overwhelming.
Well, between, you know, thinking of the Hunger Games, thinking of the Twilight series, thinking of the Harry Potter series, people cared about characters, so the authors served up more and we all walked down together with them. Do you have more in mind for Annie and Clay or characters in their story?
I hope so. I have nothing in the works right now. I have another book coming out next year that's another standalone novel that doesn't have any of these characters in it. They actually is another one that takes place in Ann Arbor, and it is another YA contemporary romance, but it is definitely not country music. It is definitely more of a, takes place in a dive bar. It's more of a rock and roll feel to it. Annie and Clay's story, I would love to keep going with it. I started kind of talking about Jason, who is Annie's drummer, and I started a book with him, and I kind of just put it to the side and just wanted to see how this one took off and see if it did take off. So I hope to pick it up again one day. I hope that the readers would like it. That would be amazing. I love this world. I love these characters. I would love to give them all a happy ending, so I hope so.
Erin Hahn's debut young adult novel is You'd Be Mine, and Erin will be at Nicholas Books along with New York Times bestselling author Karen McManus. It'll be this Thursday, the 28th, at 7 p.m. Enjoy this experience, and we're looking forward to reading about the dive bar in Ann Arbor.
Oh, thank you so very much.
Up next, why children with darker skin are facing discrimination in the adoption process.
Policy-wise, there are many changes and strategies that exist on paper. They're just not being carried out.
And then in 10 minutes, the science of grief. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Does America's adoption system treat children equally? My next guest says the answer is an emphatic no. Ron Hall is a professor of social work at Michigan State University. He's been looking at the research, and to him it seems very clear the adoption system in this country discriminates against children who have darker skin. Ron Hall, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
So you've been studying something called colorism. Tell us, how does that differ from racism?
Well, colorism was coined by a writer named Alice Walker maybe 25, 30 years ago. And it pertains to particularly intra-race groups who discriminate against one another based on lighter or darker complexion. And I think because as a nation, we're so committed to this construct of race, we miss the discrimination that takes place on the basis of skin color entirely. And social workers, other individuals who work with children who may not engage in colorism intentionally, unfortunately do so because they know so little about the topic.
So it's kind of baked into the system?
I think, unfortunately, it is germane to Western society. People may engage in racist behaviors, but they make the estimate of race on the basis of complexion. We can measure skin color, we can quantify it, but because the tradition has been wedded to race, we oftentimes miss it.
So let's talk about this whole issue of how darker-skinned children fare in the adoption system. How deep does this go?
I think it goes very deep. It's entrenched. And what's unfortunate, most social workers are not even aware that they're denigrating adoptees on the basis of their complexion. Now, part of it is market. Unfortunately, there are more requests for lighter-skinned children versus darker-skinned children. And this crosses racial lines. You may have Euro-Americans who request lighter-skinned children, but you may also have families of color who similarly request lighter-skinned children. So if you're talking about an adoption agency that is in the business of adoption for profit, then it doesn't excuse the fact, but they are no less given to discrimination on the basis of a child's skin color.
One of the paragraphs that really jumped out at me in the piece that you wrote on this for The Conversation was the fact that regardless of race, as you just said, adopting parents prefer to adopt a light-skinned child. And you cite a 1999 study by a Los Angeles adoption agency, the Institute of Black Parenting, that found as many as 40% of African-American couples said they preferred a light-skinned or a mixed-race child. Help us understand why this is.
I don't want it to sound like it's an evil intent or it's intentionally discriminatory. The fact is, a child who has lighter complexion is going to have much more opportunities in life. They're probably going to get a better education. And research has shown this. There's a correlation between skin color, income, education, and occupation. That is just a statistical fact. So if you're looking for the best opportunity for your adopted child to succeed, you're going to aspire to a child that's lighter complected. We also know that there is a value norm in terms of attractiveness for lighter complected children. And so you have the addition of a child that's more appealing, that's more attractive, also may be assumed to have a greater potential for intellectual brightness. And so that leaves their assumptions made about a darker complected child that works to their disadvantage.
And what is the impact of all of this, this discrimination that just seems to be endemic to our adoption system?
Well, unfortunately, I'm pointing a finger at social workers. The impact is the further denigration of darker complected children. You have social workers who are supposedly hired in the best interest of these children, and in fact, they're guilty of abusing those children in many situations. They may not be as enthusiastic about the adoption process involving darker complected children versus lighter complected children, and they may not be conscious of this.
Mm.
Also, they have failed to institute policies to address this issue. Now, to some extent, an adoptive parent has a right to know certain characteristics about a potential child. But my suggestion to policymakers is you don't need to make that information available to a parent unless it's in the best interest of the child, because there may be some instances where it's warranted. Anticipated deficits, intellectual challenges, that may be necessary to know. But if it's going to be based purely upon a value judgment, and in many instances for skin color it is, then I don't think adoptive parents should have a right to that information. In fact, I would disqualify them as adoptive parents.
I'm talking with Ron Hall, who is a professor of social work at Michigan State University, who wrote a piece in theconversation.com about the U.S. adoption system discriminating against darker-skinned children. And to your point about the social workers, Ron, you write that when social workers were asked about favoring children with more Caucasian features, they contended it was to insulate dark-skinned children from rejection. That seems kind of like a reach, doesn't it?
It really doesn't. And I should say I'm being critical of social workers, but I worked several years as a social worker myself before I became a member of the Academy. So I'm not on the outside looking in. I've seen these kinds of things up close and personal. And as pertains to protecting a darker complected child, well, I think that's just a rationale for a social worker doing something that doesn't conform to the social work norms and values.
So you've talked about ways to address this, including the fact that you don't feel that, unless it's a very specific reason, that the issue of a child's skin color should be part of that process. And as you say, you feel that parents who are digging into that perhaps should be disqualified.
Exactly.
What about dealing with it from the social worker end? What kind of changes and protections need to be put into place to even that playing field?
Well, believe it or not, there are many policy-wise changes and strategies that exist on paper. They're just not being carried out. When that social worker is interacting with that parent, with that potential adoptee child, they're operating as American citizens. So unless they're really conscientious, they're subject to the norms, the values, and traditions of Americans. So they need to be educated to carry out some of what's written on paper.
When you think about what we're talking about with this colorism, you call this the last taboo?
My first book was called The Color Complex, and the subtitle was The Last Taboo Among African Americans. And one of the things that frustrated me about that book is that it focused upon African Americans. But since I wrote The Color Complex, I've written several books on the other communities, and I find the same issue. You have this same tendency in the Asian community, in the Latino community, and in Native American community. In 2012, I finished a trek around the world. I have interviewed, given surveys, and held focus groups with every major racial group in the world. And I find exactly what I expected to find, that is this bias against darker complexion and a favoritism toward lighter complexion. But it's something that a lot of us are uncomfortable talking about, because if we accuse other groups of discriminating against us and we engage in the same kinds of behaviors, it's kind of embarrassing.
And what do you hope, Ron Hall, that we take away from this work that you're doing on colorism? How does the culture shift begin?
The culture shift begins by interviews such as this, by educating the population, by making this an essential part of the discourse, because we have ignored it or chosen to talk about race when we really mean skin color, then skin color kind of gets pushed aside. And I might also add, I think if we put this whole issue of discrimination in a skin color context, it's also less polarizing. So we don't have one racial group against the other. Because what I can describe as taking place between Euro-Americans, African-Americans, also takes place between Euro-Americans and Euro-Americans and African-Americans and African-Americans. So we don't have these dividing ourselves up into these various camps, which doesn't get us anywhere.
Ron Hall is a professor of social work at Michigan State University, and you can go to theconversation.com and you'll find his piece on the U.S. adoption system discriminating against darker skinned children. Ron, thank you so much for spending time and sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Grief. We all go through it. It is out there waiting for us. We never know when or how it will be our turn to grieve. The Detroit Institute of Arts is exploring grief in a very unique overnight event, beginning at 7 this evening and running all night long until 9 tomorrow morning. It is called Science of Grief. It's a chance to share stories of grief, learn about the stages of grief. It's hosted by poet and activist Natasha T. Miller. Someone who will speak tonight is my next guest, neuroscientist Dr. Yuwenda Pierce. She's with the LA Biomeds, associated with the Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Dr. Pierce, you're part of this 14-hour event to help people explore grief. You're going to actually talk about the science of grief. What does that phrase actually mean?
So the science of grief is in its infancy, and it's just how the brain responds to the experience of grief and regulates grief emotion. So it's really just about working out what the brain is doing when we are feeling the emotions that are associated with grief.
So when someone is plunged into grief, what is immediately happening in the brain? What kind of changes do we see?
Well, the interesting thing about grief is that it is universal. We all experience it, and it's not just us, but actually social birds and mammals like other non-human primates. So it's something that is important for our survival, and actually it's connected to our connections and the internal models we have for our realities, which are based on our social bonds. So when we're separated from our loved ones, we have separation distress because we need those relationships for our survival. So grief is a form of separation, but the difference is that it is permanent. So actually it's very confusing to try and adapt to this new reality. And so a lot of the emotions that we feel around grief are to do with trying to actually work out what on earth has just happened, which has completely shifted our reality.
And we hear about those five stages of grief. How accurate are those? And do most people tend to follow that track of working their way through grief?
Well, I think you're referring to the Kubler-Ross five stages of grief, which is one of the oldest models of grief. And it's actually developed into 9 different stages, including hope, anxiety, depression, denial, pain and guilt, anger and bargaining, acceptance, depression again, and also reverie and revival. And those are things that a lot of people or most people will experience, but how long they feel each of those stages for is variable between different individuals and also the order. So it is something that is common to most people's grief experience, but can look very different because it depends on the individual. And I think traditionally what's thought is that there is this acute phase of grief and then this linear progression towards a point where you've accepted the loss and the grief feelings aren't as intense. But actually, it's not a linear model in more than 50% of people. So it actually is very different between each of us.
And I'm certainly, I'm sure there will be many different stories at tonight's event at the DIA about that very thing. What are trauma genes, Dr. Pierce?
So trauma genes, that's an interesting area of research. It's to do with epigenetic changes in our genes and how this can be inherited between generations. So actually, external experiences in our environment have an impact on our genes. So that's how environment interacts with genes to affect the expression of those genes. And there is research to show that some of those changes can be passed on. In terms of the HPA axis, which is what regulates our stress response, there is research that also shows that cortisol, which is a stress hormone, can actually affect how offspring experience stress. So that's an interesting thing to consider as well.
No one gets over grief, but can people get stuck in such a deep level of mourning that they cannot move beyond that? I'm wondering, how does that deep long-term grief affect our brains?
That's a really good question. So as grief looks very different for different people, but a lot of the grief emotions are common. And also there is research to show that there are actually four ways in which people progress through grief and the time can vary. So most of us, the good news is we have a resilient type of grief where we're able to still experience positive emotions as well as our grief emotions. And actually that's associated with a healthy coping style. But actually, there are different forms of grief, such as chronic grief progressions and depressive improved and chronic depression, which looks slightly different. So for chronic, it's usually in people who have had a lot of reliance on the person that they've lost. So there are significant emotional pangs and yearning, which can be more prolonged, maybe take up to 4 years rather than the 18-month period that's more common for people with resilient grief. And then there is chronic depression, which is usually predicted by a high pre-loss depression level. And so it's more to do with mood disturbance. But that is still normal grief. Even though it's very painful, it's normal. But for 7% of individuals, they actually can go on to develop something called complex grief. And that's actually clinical and can be diagnosed by the DSM-5. And that's quite different because that can last from months to actually many years and is usually diagnosed after 12 months. And people with this form of grief, there's research to show it's to do with the reward centers in the brain. There's interesting research that I'm going to talk about this evening, where actually it might have to do with how the reward centers in the brain are being activated in these people rather than just the pain centers. And that is related to the addictive processes associated with when you stimulate reward centers in the brain. So that's quite interesting. But that is something that is even higher in people who have lost a spouse or in child bereavement. That's 20 to 25% can go on to develop complex grief.
Hmm. What is the significance of this event tonight at the DIA going on through the night?
I think grief is felt very much during the night when you are alone and you're alone with your thoughts. And this is when a lot of intrusive thoughts can come in. So sort of yearning for the person that you've lost. And of course, your yearning isn't going to lead to being reunited with that person, as is the case with just separation. And so I think it's really relevant, in fact, to do this event overnight, because that's when people are most vulnerable to grief as well. And I think what's interesting about it is that by having this event with, you know, everyone together, it actually kind of counteracts that as well. So I think that's a really great decision that Natasha made for this event.
The event is The Science of Grief. It will be happening overnight, starting at 7 tonight, running through 9 tomorrow morning at the Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And you can get information about this free event by going to DIA.org. And one of the speakers there to talk about the science of grief will be my guest, Dr. Yolanda Pierce. She's with the LA Biomeds, associated with the Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us, and I'm sure it'll be really an interesting and hopefully very helpful event for people tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer was Bob Scon, and our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Adam Reyes, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.